This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Good morning.
Hey, everybody.
Welcome to, I welcome myself to Hartford Street Zen Center, and I welcome all of you here, too. But maybe some of you are more familiar with it. I live at the San Francisco Zen Center. I'm a resident there. I'm on the staff there. And we're kind of cousins, or maybe we're the uncle or something of Hartford Street. But when I first came to, when I first went to the Zen Center in my 20s, when I was about 20 years old, the very first person I met was Isan, founder of this temple. Then known as Tommy. He was a really warm-hearted person, and it wasn't, you know, he was one of the reasons that I stayed, that I continued to come go to the Zen Center, because he was such a nice guy and kind of like seemed so welcoming and not at all intimidating, even though I was a little intimidated by all the robes and the lofty spiritual attainments of the residents. It was even for a while, actually. I'd say I was almost like an Isan's posse. You know, he and a few, maybe there were four or five of us, and we were kind of like a little kind of gang. He was not exactly the leader of the gang, but we all kind of respect, you know, lots of times we did things that we had the idea to do, you know, like watch Kung Fu in his room on his TV, things like that, yeah. As a kind of part of that, I always feel such a, in my heart, I don't know, an appreciation of this temple, which he founded. So, thank you, Tommy, his son, for being who you were, who you are. So, I want to talk. I want to talk about Zazen. I want to talk about Zen practice. I want to talk about Buddhism. Mostly, I want to say some things about Zazen because it's the first of all, I assume everyone here knows what the word Zazen means. But Zazen is the word. It's kind of like it's a Japanese word which we've just sort of brought into English, and now we consider it an English word that that describes meditation in the Zen tradition. Okay, and the Zen and Zazen. Those are the same characters. And I think the za means like sitting zen. Za, sitting zen. But zen means sitting as well. It means meditative absorption. So sort of zazen is the meditation practice. It's the common denominator that connects different traditions, lineages of Buddhism, of Zen Buddhism. And Buddhism itself. Zazen itself, on its own, like meditation, doesn't have an intrinsic merit. It's not like because we meditate we're a better person. We might be a better person because we meditate, but it's not because like the act of sitting down is itself transformative. What is transformative is when we work it. You know, it's kind of like you know, here I am, so I'm saying words to you guys. And that's how it all starts. That's how it started for me. I went to the Zen Center and I listened to a talk about Zazen, and the talk was in words. You know, And then, you know, but before that, actually, I had read about Zazen, and I'd read about that before I heard the words. And then when I was at the Zen Center, not only did I kind of like read about it, but then I talked with some people about it. Okay? I went to meditate instruction. I heard, you know, this is what you do. But there's a kind of insufficiency to that description, to that process. It's a little bit like if you want to be a cook, if you're reading cookbooks. At some point, if you really want to be a good cook, you've got to get in the kitchen and cook. And if you want to be a good Zen student, you've got to sit on the cushion, on the meditation cushion, and cook. Cook yourself. How do you cook yourself? Well, by being still and noticing what comes up. By allowing yourself to be not moved by those things that move us. There is a, you know, we come in, we sit down on a cushion, on a chair, or wherever. We sit in a mindful fashion, and one of the things that, and we pay attention to our breathing. That's a sort of simple description of Zazen. The fact of the matter, though, is, at least, excuse me, I can't speak for anyone else but for myself. The fact of that what happens when I do that is actually my thought stream continues. Stuff, that, you know, the rhythm of my life, the river of my life continues. And even though it, I might be photographable as deeply in contemplation, you know, but inside, it doesn't just follow. It's not like you just sit down and do that. Except maybe it does. I don't want to deny there's something to that, but I want to. But maybe from the point I want to make is that we have to start to. We begin by acknowledging kind of like the garbage that's in our mind, the stuff, the menu planning, the relationship crisis, the bitter enemy that we can't quite believe happens to be in the Sangha besides us. You know? We start off by, when we sit down, that's the stuff, that's the shit, excuse me, but that's the kind of compost that we work with. And one of the, and we don't work with it, well, all day long we work with this stuff, mostly. You know, all day long we think about things and we think about the movies and whatever. But so if we come into the Zendo and do that, then we're kind of a little bit wasting our time. You know, we've got a better thing to do when we come to the Zendo. When we come to the Zendo, we actually, when we come to the meditation hall, like this room, we try to stop that dialogue. We try to learn, try to see who we are by not pursuing these fundamentally trivial but also sometimes momentous ideas we have. So, in meditation is a kind of a big topic. There's lots of different schools of Buddhism and there's lots of different meditation techniques, and there's mantras and guided meditations and etc. etc. So. And they have each their own merit. The Zen tradition, the Zen school, not entirely, not 100%, but mostly 99.9%, kind of, at least in the Soto, in this tradition we follow, recommends that we sit without gaining idea, and just sit with an awareness of our breath, and work on ourselves in that way. I remember at one point after I kind of gotten into Zen Center, I was engaged to the practice, and I thought, you know, this is actually kind of boring. I mean, or it's not boring, or it's, but it's kind of like simple. It's it's not as highfalutin as I imagined. You know, you just simply sit with yourself, and then notice what comes up. And but when you notice what comes up, you drop it. You know, it's like a personification of the in Buddhism. One of the metaphors for Buddhism is the middle way. You know, so Zen meditation is sort of like the middle way personified. We sit upright where we are, and when thoughts and ideas come to us, we don't recoil away from them, we don't jump upon them and grab hold of them and run with them, we just sit in the middle of it. And it takes an energetic effort to remain in that place. It takes actually some energy, to sustain that, to not fall into the kind of like the fantasy dream world that we somehow think is really our life. There was a Zen teachers meeting that I was attended about a year ago, and Jan Bays, who lives up in Oregon with her husband, and they have a Zen center up there. She gave a talk, and in the talk, she said that she's been studying with her teacher passed away some years ago. She's been studying with another Japanese teacher, even though she herself is a teacher and theoretically doesn't need to kind of be given any more permission to teach. But for her own health, she thought it was really good that she continued working with somebody. And this pretty highly respected Japanese Zen teacher. There's a bunch of, I think he's Harada Roshi, but there's a bunch of Haradas in this world, so I'm not sure. Told her that if you really practice Shikantaza, Shikantaza is the word we use, the technical descriptive word we use for this type of sitting in meditation without gaining idea, without kind of non-dualistic. He said, if you really practice Shikantaza, after 10 or 15 minutes, you'll be drenched with sweat. It takes that much energy. And I don't know, for those of you who have done like one-day sittings or seven-day longer retreats, there actually is a kind of like a meditation stink. I feel like for myself, I noticed my... This is, stupid, but I guess it's technical words, B.O. I noticed my... We all have something called B.O., body odor, And mostly, I don't smell myself. I just mostly I kind of like think, I take a shower and things like that. But in Sesshin, even though I will take a shower every day, there's actually kind of like something when I'm really plugged into it and actually making an effort, I actually feel kind of like that. I'm scouring something inside me is being scoured. Some like stuff is being loosened and expelled. It's not so simple to simply sit and follow your breath. Anyway. So these are, you're saying some stuff about Zazen. And, this. All this stuff that kind of like that comes up in our hearts and minds when we try to actually not have, when we try to just stop, is like the compost for our practice. And like a good farmer, compost takes discarded stuff and even takes the input of, what's the polite word? Excrement. And turns it into kind of a fragrant, rich, fertile soil. And that's something we try to do in Zazen, to make our whole life be compost that smells good when it's cooked. sit. We notice our sit bones. We try to keep our nose in line with our belly button. I don't want to underemphasize. I want to say that even though for some reason not everybody gets into it as much as I think I do, but this holding your hands in this mudra position is for me a really essential part of my effort. It's part of me. It's somehow want to just encourage those of you who maybe does everybody use. Some people put their hands on their knees and do other things besides using this classic meditation mudra. Does anyone in the room want to confess that they don't really do the cosmic mudra? Yeah, well, that's fine.
I do this a lot.
Yeah.
That counts.
Uh huh. Well, that's okay too. There is a kind of a, in a way, over hundreds of years, there's a technology of sitting. It's been refined, and some of the technology of sitting, it's not high tech. it's kind of, but it's been considered. You know, things like things like how we sit. Even though I have some knee problems right now, and I'm having a trouble with my cross-legged posture, it in fact is a comfortable way to sit. It's a very stable way. The cross-legged position, and I also think when I do like retreats, like you know, for one period of zazen, yes, but also for a week or day long, I put a lot of attention to my thumb tips lightly touching and my mudra resting in my lap lightly, so that the back, if this is the back of my mudra, you know, where my little pinky is, where it touches the fabric of my clothes, my robe or whatever. That it's not just fixed there, but it's held so that the subtle breathing in and breathing out motion of my abdomen moves. I can feel a tiny, it's very modest, tactile sensation of motion at the back of my mudra. And I will focus on that location. It's too difficult to not have any focus, to not have any kind of thing to hang your zazen effort on. We say, well, just sit in and come in and sit down and with no gaining idea, follow your breath. For myself, I've had some experience of that, but at the same time, usually it's more accessible. Meditation is more accessible for me if I pick something that's going to be my object of concentration. And I could say that my object of concentration is my breath, but that's kind of also almost really a big topic. You know? So I generally, when I remember, I don't always remember. It's a strange thing. You know, I don't always remember this. But I generally put my awareness on the back of my mudra as it touches my belly and make that the location of my concentration effort. There's one virtue to that besides all the other virtues too, but one virtue is that it's located in my belly, you know, and by putting my awareness down in that spot below my belly button, I'm actually making an effort to not have my focus of awareness and kind of like of my focus in my head. I'm moving it down to my belly. I read everything I know from the internet. And I read on the New York Times website a couple months ago, maybe it was a year ago, an article about, this is not news to anybody else, but it was news to me, about the incredibly concentrated kind of brain that exists in our gut. And that the amount of neurons and synapses, this kind of stuff that happened, that's happening down in this part of our body, is on the same level as the amount of stuff that happens in our head.
Why it's called a gut feeling? I got a gut feeling about this?
That's exactly why. And that's why also when suddenly our heart is broken, you know, we feel it in our belly. It's like a belly kick, you know. When things happen, they're kind of like significant, And this process of putting your hands in your mudra and down in your lap, and then bringing your breath awareness to, as you breathe in and out, feeling your stomach rise up and rise down, is a kind of way of becoming intimate with this fundamental brain that we have that really does guide us in ways that we don't know. So anyway, I recommend this if you're interested. So breathing, you know, it's one of those things. You get, you know, you get knocked on the head with a baseball, or some, God forbid, something happens. You know, you're not, but we still breathe. Like our heart keeps beating, and we still keep breathing. Okay, these are like really fundamental. At the first moment when you're born, you know, the doctor slaps the little baby's butt, and there's a cry, and the breath is taken in, and life force is independent and begins. Breathing is really a kind of like maybe reptiles are great. I would call it reptilian. You know, it's a part of the part of our functioning that goes below the human volitional arena, and
I have a question for you. For being a Buddhist, if you die, where do you go?
I don't know. And there will be a time for questions, I think, right after the talk. So I'd be happy to, you can ask that question again, and maybe someone else in the room might
have. I'm not gonna lie to you, I'm not a Buddhist, I'm a Christian.
Yeah, that's okay, but actually it's my turn to talk right now. So, okay.
I don't even know what you're talking about. Yeah.
That's fine, you don't have to know what you're talking about, but I request you to be quiet and listen.
No, I'm going
to
leave. Okay, that's okay. I'm a Christian, and what you're saying is false doctrine. I'm actually a minister.
Yeah, I think it is. But you're welcome, I'm sure, on some other occasion, but not to disrupt this.
I sit in every other doctrine.
Yeah. But you don't... I think you really need to understand that you're a guest here and that you need to respect the house and allow this false doctrine, such as it might be, to have its own expression. Okay. So kindly, I ask you if you would be quiet and not interrupt my talk. Is that okay?
I'm going to go because...
Well, then go.
I have to go to work.
Okay.
But either way, okay. I'm a minister of Christ, Jesus Christ. I don't know who Buddha is. Buddha was a man that believed in Jesus Christ. I'm a minister, bro. Straight up. I went to college for that. Bible college. I grew up like that. Sir, you're not helping people. I can help you more than you can help yourself. Take it easy.
Take it easy, too. I wish you well.
Bye.
We live in such a wonderful world. And, you know, I'll tell you one thing. One thing that I love about... is that people can say whatever they want. Okay? But what I don't like is when people think that what someone else says... Even though I sometimes think this is about Mitt Romney, it's foolish. Yeah. So maybe I do the same thing. You know, I remember I sometimes listen to political speeches and I think, God damn, what a fool. You know. So anyway, a cornerstone of my understanding of Buddhism is a tolerance for other viewpoints. And an uncertainty that what we have to say is really the truth. I don't know if how often the Dalai Lama writes op-ed pieces for the New York Times, but about 2 years ago, he was at some scientific conference, and in the New York Times, it was an op-ed piece written about science and religion by the Dalai Lama. And he said, and this is what made me love the guy, he said, if there is any teaching in Buddhism that is proven to be impossible or implausible or incorrect because of scientific, because it flies in the face of science, you know, demonstrable double blind test science, you know, he said, well, then Buddhism just needs to drop it. Because there's no need. There's enough truth to Buddhism that we don't need to hold views that are in opposition to the physical reality of this world system. Viva Dalai Lama. Some time ago, I've shared this anecdote previously at City Center, but it was something that, you know, well, how can I say it? What I want to say is that our whole life is the arena of Zazen. Our whole life is the way we don't measure our meditation success by kind of good feelings and groovy sensations that might happen in the meditation hall. Sometimes we're encouraged to continue because we can get in kind of like this almost like runner's high endorphin thing. Zazen can kind of get us in a groove. But that's actually not the reason we practice Zazen. The reason we practice Zazen is so that we can be upright and meet people and meet ourselves and cook the stuff that's inside ourselves so that when it comes out and we present our version of reality to other people, that it's fragrant, attractively fragrant, that it's not not awkward. I was shopping, this is the thing I mentioned over at City Center, I was on 18th Street, the Buy-Right Market, which is one of my favorite places. I was there a few days ago. Yeah, I love Buy-Right. And I was in the checkout line. Sometimes they have a long line there. Yeah, I was in there. I was along by one of the deli case, and you know, several people away from being at the register. And I heard a voice from behind me, someone else in the checkout line, say, "That guy up there, he's a Zen priest." Yeah, someone recognized me from City Center. I knew they were talking about me. There wasn't another plausible Zen priest. and I felt like outed, you know. I felt that because actually I didn't really want to be a Zen priest at that moment. I just wanted to, you know, be at Buy-Right Market and, you know, and get my smoked ham bits and things like that, you know. So, you know, and of course, I didn't turn around to look at who that person was to see if I recognized him because I didn't recognize the voice. I kind of didn't want to acknowledge that I'd overheard this, but meanwhile also, I increased my stature by about a half inch. Slightly. I kind of lengthened my back, you know, a little bit and tucked my chin in, you know, and I adopted a slightly more noble bearing, you know. So, but actually, why in the world was I waiting to be reminded? You know, this is the way we should live. This is the way we should walk around all the time, with the awareness that people see us and they know who we are. You know, that and actually, we want to be known. You know, that's what it's one of the big laments in the world, in the urban, and I forget what, it's a big lament of the modern days that in some ways we don't feel, lots of people don't feel seen. But, you know, the way of being seen starts by seeing yourself and expressing yourself nobly. That's one of the things about Isan that was so good. You know, in private moments and in public moments, he was very consistent. Which part of that meant that in public moments he didn't hide his delusion too. It wasn't like he didn't. He was really an encouraging person to be around because he let you see his garbage. But it wasn't. But he owned it for himself. At least that's my recollection. Some of the pieces of him. So we when I started practicing, I kind of thought a couple years and I'll be really good, or pretty good, but it takes years. It takes a long time to actually kind of get around to understanding who we were when we started practice, who we are when without, who we really are. And I've seen, in my time at the San Francisco Zen Center, I've seen people come through who were kind of like bright stars, They had, they seemed like they really got it. And to a large extent, some of them, I don't know where they are now. They sort of like, they did really practice really strongly and were at everything, and now, I don't know, they're just not around. But some of the people who struggled, who actually had a hard time, are still at it. And my heart goes to them, because that's kind of where I see myself a little bit too. I've struggled. After 5 or 6 years or 8 years of practice, I became disillusioned, in various ways, for various reasons, which were more about myself, but it was my disillusionment was needed to be acknowledged, and so I kind of gave up on the whole thing for a while. But I didn't really give up on it, I actually thought about it, a lot, but I gave up on making it look like I was practicing. I needed to do that, and there's in the literature of Zen, of the Zen tradition, there's a whole body of anecdotal stories about teachers, and I think I have a story about somebody who gave up. Let me see if I remember now what I have here. There's a. If you hang out at the Zen Center, you'll eventually start hearing stories about Chinese Zen teachers who were the founders of this tradition. And so I'm going to tell you one of those Chinese founder stories. The purpose of the intention, I believe, of knowing about these historic encounters and teachers. It's not because we want to kind of give them, think of them as isolated phenomena, event, experiences, but because we want to use that story as a way to sort of see if we can, in ourselves, awaken that place. But by using these, by if you study Zen after a while and you start to read about these Chinese Zen ancestors, you learn a kind of vocabulary. It's like another aspect of this kind of low-tech technology of Zazen and Zen training, having these stories in your heart. So there was a great, very great Chinese Zen teacher named Guishan. And he lived in the Tang Dynasty. He had a monastery with 1,500 sentinels. Now, but it's interesting that alongside, right after, you know, it said he was the head of a temple with 1,500 monks, and then it says in his little biographical thing, of which 43 had awoken. Now, that's actually a lot, but also 1,500, and there's 40, you know, because there's almost some implied thing that, like, you can succeed or fail at this. What does it mean? 1,500 monks, but 43 of them opened their Dharma eye? You know? I'm not going to go too far. I'm just, well, one of those who had not opened his Dharma eye was a student of Guishan's named, I'm not saying the Chinese correctly, I'm sure, Ling Yun. He'd lived in the monastery for 30 years. Actually, he'd lived in various temples for 30 years. But, excuse me. But it says in his bio, in the little, like, Andy Ferguson has this great book about Chinese Zen teachers. It's about, for Ling Yun, it said, after 30 years of training, he still had an unsettled heart. And one spring day, he took a walk. Maybe a day like this. Beautiful. But this is not spring, but anyway. But a beautiful. It's in the story. It was a lovely day. And he walked in the mountains surrounding the temple, and he reached a point where he, a meadow where he rested and stopped, and he looked across the little valley, and he saw across the way a village. And framing the village around some of the houses, there were peach trees that were in blossom. And at the sight of those peach trees in blossom, it's said that he had a significant experience. He kind of realized at that moment that things were just right. That was a noble moment for him. And in some ways, even though I don't want to attribute too much to any of these little brief moments that are fleeting and go away, but at that moment, all of the years of his practice ripened ripened inside him. He experienced that he had what's called an experience of the moment that was profoundly complete. So he went back to Guishan, who had known him for a long time. And he said to his teacher, "For 30 years I looked for an answer. Many times leaves fell, new ones sprouted. Today, one glimpse of peach blossoms. Now, no more doubts, just this. Just this." He actually wrote this and presented this poem. He wrote it as a kind of poem which he gave to his teacher. And when his teacher read the poem, he said, "One who enters with ripened causes will never go away." Whatever that might mean. We're missing. I'm sure we would have heard something about what that. That might have prompted a question. It prompts a question in me. What does it mean to enter with ripened causes? practice is a kind of mysterious gate. You know, it responds to causes and conditions. It responds to our intention. It responds to the surroundings we allow ourselves to enter into our life. And practice is something that ripens in moments least expected. Yeah. I wouldn't want anybody who has seen flowering tree and didn't feel completely sufficient in the moment, I wouldn't want you to feel bad about yourself. It's okay. Because there is, in some ways, the fact is that you are sufficient in yourself, even right now in this room as we fidget and kind of wonder how long this talk is going to go. Zazen opens us up. I really think it opens us up wide. But there's a sort of paradoxical thing that is, we make an effort to sit still and not move, and we make an effort to, in some ways, limit the object of our awareness. Instead of being kind of like when you're driving down the street, you're looking ahead, you're next to the next intersection, there's a light turning green. How many seconds are ticking down on that little kind of thing that tells you when the light will change? There's a radio, and you don't like the commercial, so you push the button. And, that's kind of like we're multi-processing entities. But in Zazen, we become so single processors. So we drop all of that myriad activity, which happens so easily and without much effort, and we do something which takes an enormous amount of effort, which is we just simply sit still and not follow our thoughts. We all, myself, I sometimes think that the daydreaming is my best friend. I'm an expert at daydreaming. Even right now, as I said, that I started thinking about this afternoon what I was going to do. just like right there. When is it going to get over, and then what am I? And so in Zazen, we really make an effort, and that's why if we did do this, you're going to break out in sweat, because it's the hardest thing you can to simply not be looking past the moment, to simply be there. And why? It's not because it's because we learn something about ourselves in doing that. We learn something about how we want to move by constraining ourselves. The effort to concentrate our effort into a single activity is a gateway to a very broad space. It's a gateway to kind of like opening our heart wide. It's almost might seem paradoxical, but it doesn't seem at all paradoxical in the moment that if you accomplish it, it just seems the right way. Katagiri Rushi, who was somebody Isan studied with, has a little short practice poem. It's called Peaceful Life. And it says, knowing how to live, knowing how to walk with people, demonstrating and teaching, this is the Buddha way. Knowing how to live, knowing how to walk with people, demonstrating and teaching, this is the Buddha way. Well, I'm going to just say, knowing how to live and knowing how to walk with people, that's the Buddha way. Zazen, Zen practice, is kind of pragmatic. Even though there are ethereal, lofty, philosophical treatises can be studied and engaged in, for the most part, it's pragmatic. And of course, there's that side. There is an intellectual side of it, and there's a kind of understanding the history and the poetry of this expression. But all of that is actually almost like icing on the cake. The cake itself is a simple thing. It's a simple cake. It's 11. And, two other pages of things I have here to say, I will save for maybe some other time. But I'll end by a poem by Leonard Cohen. I love Leonard Cohen. Why do I love Leonard Cohen? I don't know. Yeah. I love Leonard Skinner, too. Yeah. But Leonard Cohen, who is a singer and various things, and also is a pretty serious Zen student, very serious Zen student, ordained with a Japanese teacher who lives in LA. The name of the poem is The Lovesick Monk. The Lovesick Monk. I shaved my head. I put on robes. I sleep in the corner of a cabin 6,500 feet up a mountain. It's dismal here. The only thing I don't need is a comb. He doesn't. Yeah. Well, that's it. Thank you very much.
Do you have a question?
Do we? Yeah. Is that? Cause I don't. You know. Is that? I don't know what. Where I come from, we get up, leave, mill around, and then we have questions later. So, but yes. Does anybody have a question or questions? I hope they're easy. Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Did you know we have three visitors?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. I figure you guys are, you know,
founding. They have to do a presentation on what they experienced here today at their school.
Uh-huh. What school do you go to?
Conrad.
Yeah. Do you have any questions yourself? Or later on, Hartford Street can give you my email address. If you want to follow up, if it would be useful for your presentation, if you want some background information or something, okay, I might even have a business card, God forbid, with my email address on it, okay, if that's useful for you.
So they got to experience a kind of interfaith thing here today with our
visitor. Yes.
With the Jesus and the
Christian. Yeah.
And the belief and then our practice
kind of
juxtaposed.
Yes.
So I thought that was really.
You weren't expecting that, were you?
No.
Neither was I. Yeah. I tell you, Hartford Street's not that, friendly. No, it's not my friend usually.
But that was a good experience, yeah. To watch what rises up inside when someone could be a thought or a person comes in.
That's right.
They're a bit aggressive or they're self-absorbed, but they're dismissive. So it's like,
I tell you, life is too short to walk around looking for people you want to disagree with. You know, just really. I hope that he can find his birds of the feathers, or we can flock together with them later on for the rest of the day and not be amending and correcting people. So, any follow up question or comment? Yes?
Thank you for your talk, Reverend Thorne. I think, you know, sometimes it's a question that gets asked all the time, but I'm always interested in sort of what's the answer right now. And Soto practice for me sometimes, if I'm feeling discouraged, you know, where's that place of encouragement come from with the practice without gaining an idea?
Mm-hmm.
And so just, I mean, if you could just maybe say that.
Well, it's useful. That's why we practice in the Sangha, you know. Sometimes we... I'm not going to promise. I wouldn't even want to think that your practice is authentic if you didn't get discouraged, you know. Okay, but there is a secret of success, which is to continue. Having faith in that is something sometimes helpful. Another thing is sometimes, you know, even though I think on the whole teachers are overrated. But having somebody who you talk to, a senior, That's useful. You know? But the and now I mean this is not about you. This is about me. I felt when I was discouraged that it wasn't that the practice was inadequate, but I felt like my own heart was like restless or something. I think that it's a beautiful practice, and to live the values of benefiting others, keeping living in accord with the precepts ethically, to have the heart of wanting to be the bodhisattva's vow of helping other people and offering yourself as a gift. These things are all kind of like, it doesn't get much better. I get better, but it doesn't get much better. But when I'm not in touch with that and I feel discouraged, it's difficult for me, but I try to be aware that it's not the failure of... Like, I think Zazen, like meditation, which without any gaining idea, it's like it's like a blank slate. I mean, I put a lot onto it sometimes. I don't know where I'm going here. Has someone else helped me? Yeah.
I've been practicing, I don't know how long I've been practicing, 30 years?
You're asking me?
Something. Yeah.
And all of my years of my practice have been... I'm a terrible student. All these body things, and so I, move things, and every so often I just come up and complete throw my hands. It's just an absolute part. This is a matter of mind as well. Day one. This is all shit. It's all shit. But in the last 2 years, something weird has happened. Somehow, there is this just utterly, almost, just about imperceptible that has started meaning more and more to me. And sometimes I can't even touch it or feel it until later, and sometimes right even in the process of being the big piece of shit that I am. And but it's there. There's this generally invisible, intangible handle. There's something to that. I was trying to address.
Well said. Well said. Great.
Thank you.
Right.
I think I've given up on having to be any idea. So if I just decide that I'm going to try to be a little calmer and a little nicer, what's wrong with that?
That's fine. But also, there is an enormous possibility that you have and that we all have within us that's even more than just getting a little bit nicer. Okay? But sometimes, like to turn the ship of state, we're grateful for the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step type of thing. But I don't think that Buddhism would still be here in the world, in nearly every country in the world, if Buddha said, "I want everybody to be a little bit nicer." There's something more. There's some more potential that I think gives us more of a backbone to the possibility. that okay? Is that what do you think?
Well, so what is that?
I can't say.
Kind of like the Bruce was talking about.
Some of that more stuff, could be misinterpreted if said, some of that more stuff is the type of thing that teacher-student talk about.